Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer.
And we're here at the Slowdown's New York headquarters. You're listening to Time Sensitive, a podcast where we profile curious and courageous people in business, the arts, and beyond, who have a distinct perspective on time.
This week on the podcast, we've got the inventor, designer, entrepreneur, Tony Fadell. It's our season finale.
It is the last one. Season two. We'll be back in March, though, for season three. Thank you so much for tuning in for the last couple seasons.
Yep. And super excited that Tony's here because he's a big fan of the Slowdown and been a good supporter of ours. What'd you guys talk about?
So, you know, I wanted to have Tony on for a few reasons. Number one, he's been integral in building some of the products that have really changed our lives. You know, iPod, iPhone, Nest, and sort of the advent of the smart home. And then after all of these things, he moved on and he started mentoring and building incubators, one of them Future Shape outside of Paris, which has been really an important hub for deep technology happening outside of Silicon Valley, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. But the real reason I wanted to have him on is because there's very few people I've ever met or known that have been able to constantly reinvent themselves after success or failure. You know, he's someone who really has constantly stayed curious and kept his eyes wide open and is consistently looking for challenges that he can create solutions for. It's very inspiring to be around someone like that. Mm. And I wanted to share his story. And I think oftentimes people see people like Tony with immense sort of public success that it's always been easier. There's always been successes. But actually, when you go through the trajectory of his life, he's actually stumbled quite a few times and figured out ways to get back up, and he has a lot of insights in that space. Mm. So that's why I wanted to have him on.
Great. Well, yeah, I mean, I think we all need to be thinking about reinvention as we head into 2020. So good way to end the season. Here's Tony and Andrew.
Tony Fadell is the inventor of the iPod, co-inventor of the iPhone, and founder and former CEO of Nest Labs. He's currently the principal at Future Shape, an investment and advisory firm that coaches deep tech startups. Throughout his career, Fadell has authored more than 300 patents and shifted the way we interact with technology. Welcome, Tony. It's great to have you back in New York.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for making time for us. So I guess I saw you last on the other side of the world in Bali, where you've been living for the past year. Why Bali?
Well, Bali was just a crazy lark, which was I had heard of a school 10 years ago, 11 years ago now, and it was called the Green School. And I saw the presentation. I was there in the audience at TED when it was given, and I was like, wow, that seems really intriguing. But my kids were 1 and 2 at the time, something like that. And so it was always in the back of my mind, and I got introduced to the founder of the school. And he gave me his card, and it was on bamboo. It was a
John
bamboo
Hardy.
Card, John Hardy. And I was like, wow. And so I always kept that bamboo card on my desk. And then when I did my TED Talk 4 or 5 years back, his daughter was on at the same time. She was came right on after me, something like that, on stage. And so we rekindled. I re-met, I guess you could say, John and then his daughter. And that got the wheels turning, crazy turning. And so I was like, oh, yeah, this might be the right time. So I go back to Paris because we're living in Paris then. And then I start meeting people and start telling them about Green School. There was a person I met and he's like, I'm going to Bali. And I'm like, you're going to Green School? He's like, exactly. And so in a process of 6 weeks, literally I'm 4 or 5 different families that I knew or I knew of or friends knew had either been at the school or were going to the school. And I was just like, it's a sign. And so that's what all, how it happened. And so literally, I never even went to Bali once in my life.
That was the first time you landed when you moved there?
Exactly. Literally, I was supposed to go and I had an accident, an injury, and I couldn't go. So my wife went for basically 72 hours. And she came back and said, we're going. I said, okay, we're going. And
fantastic.
It was that quick.
And What did you find in the year that did it kind of inform the way you were thinking about the world? What did you experience the year there?
So a whole different way of life. In almost every which way, it was different. It was 180 degrees different from Silicon Valley, from Paris, right? And it was very refreshing. You know, when you drive around, there's not big ads anywhere. You know, you're lucky if you can find a movie theater. You're lucky if you can find any kind of shopping as we would know it in a, you know, in a world-class city. And so the way I compare life in Bali compared to life in, let's say, Paris or New York, is that a city, when you're living in a city like New York, everybody's shouting at you. Like, all these brands are shouting at you, pick me, come to this theater, come to this show, art show, or what have you, this concert. So the whole world's shouting at you. And you just have to say no, no, no. And it's literally like, it's entertaining you. When you're in Bali, it's the complete opposite. It's very passive. You have to figure out what you want to do. Not everything's yelling at you, shouting, saying, pick me. You have to literally go and go figure out what you want to do and try to look inward. And you have to figure out how to light up things inside of yourself to figure out what you want to do. And so that's been really, really interesting because you're not just following along with the masses, which is great.
And your experience of time shifted while you were there.
Right. You know, I'm a big watch collector and I love watches. I love all the mechanical nature of it. But when you're there, you say, okay, you don't need one. You're just, you have a different, like, there's Bali time. And everybody shows up at, you know, around a time, but not at a time. And it's
also
nice.
Known for, like, beauty and kind of a certain community interest in the metaphysical and the sort of healing arts. What of that did you engage in?
So in the first, I would say in the first 24 to 48 hours, you feel it. You don't, you just look around and you go, oh my God, look at all of this beauty, this religion, this community. And you just kind of go, whoa, this is cool. And you're like, I want to know more. So you start reading books or you start learning more about Bali and the cultures and you learn about how the families live, how multiple families live together. And you start going, wait a second, there's something really cool there. And one really interesting data point for me was that, you know, they have 4 to 4.5 million vehicles on this island. But there's less than 100 traffic lights on the island. Like, everything ebbs and flows and it moves like, you know, like a bloodstream, right? There's no stoplights. There's none of this kind of order. But yet there is an order to everything. And people, you know, say, oh, why don't you go in front of me? Why don't you, you're not, people aren't honking. There's not all of this kind of stuff. And you're like, there's something different about the mindset there that allows that kind of controlled chaos in a way to happen, and it works. And so you start going, I need to know more about this because it's about the mindset of how they grow up and how they work together to make their community as opposed to relying on the government to make it. Because each of them are kind of like these mini governments all around the, and they're it's a compound. So a compound has a few families in it. And that has about 45 people in a compound. And those compounds then come together and they become a banjar. And a banjar could be 20 compounds together. And that's like a mini city. And each of them have their different sets of community services that happen. And each person has a different role to play. But they all have to work together. It's not like the government comes in and does everything for them. They work together. And because of that, and they live multi-generational in one house, in a banjar, there's a real sense of community. And, you know, when things go wrong, everybody just laughs there. They go, oh, that's just life. That's how it is. I guess we didn't please the gods today, so we'll just do a better job tomorrow. There's not a lot of angst and anger and things like that. So when you're around that kind of energy, very different than a first world city where everybody's trying to, you know, beat each other out.
Especially Paris.
Paris or New York or whatever. It's a whole different energy.
How into like sound baths, yoga, this sort of wellness stuff did you get into?
Well, for me, I've always been into yoga. So it was great to have that. But I went right into sound healing for the first time. And I've always been, you know, about sound in terms of music and those things. It really gets into my inner core and drives me. But when I experienced sound healing for the first time, I was like, oh my God, this is a whole different area of my life that I need to have. And, you know, plunging deep into it, literally very, very deep, trying to, going one-on-one sessions, doing multi-hour sessions. And it was transformative in terms of how I felt, how I looked at the world, how the world felt to me. So I'm still in the journey. It's still very early days. Mm. Lots to learn.
You're really passionate about change. It's one of the things I think so much about you, and transformation and constantly sort of reinventing. Sometimes we need to change physical locations to do that. So I'd love to hear a bit about that from you, how possibly the spaces we're in can hold us back from the growth we're trying to experience.
Change. Especially location. So, you know, I went to 12 schools in 15 years. So we were changing locations every 2 to 3 years when growing up. And through that, I looked at it as, you know, it was a very gut-wrenching because you're leaving friends and, you know, you're the new kid all the time. And so there was a lot of that going on. So not always positive. But then on the flip side, you got to observe all the time different people and different ways of living. And it was intriguing because what I learned through that and then subsequent years was human nature is the same everywhere. It's definitely the same everywhere. There might be different ways it comes out, but in the end of the day, everybody has basically the same needs, the same ways that they interact. And so that was really helpful in my early career because we would have people from the East Coast working with people from the West Coast. And they're like, this New Yorker guy, he's so like aggro. And I'm like, no. That's just how they talk. Because I grew up on like Long Island. So I was like around here. So I was like, no, that's just them. Don't worry about that. Or, you know, Texans or whatever, different places where I was. So that was really helpful in my career. But as I was in Silicon Valley for so long, it was great to get outside and gain so much perspective. Because when you're in a bubble like that, you start to think the whole world is like that.
Mm.
And you narrow your focus and you're like, oh, there's only so many problems. There's only so many ways of being. There's, you know, and you have this defined palette. And when you get outside of that and you start to look around again and not be the person you were in Silicon Valley, but you're open to the new community you're living in, then that brings, you're asking tons of questions. Why do you live that way? You know, you in the States, we have this mentality, at least for me growing up, was the U.S. was everything. Everybody from other countries wanted to come to the U.S. because it did everything the best. And you go to other places and you go, wait a second. They do some things really, really smart, very creative, very different. And you're like, no, not everything in the U.S. is perfect. U.S. is great, but it's not everything's perfect. And no, there's a lot of improvements can be done there. But you have to gain that perspective. You have to get outside and see how other people live. And so now we've made it a point, like going to Bali. So I was like, I've never been, but let's go. What the hell? It just seems like it's the right thing to do. Going and living in Paris. We experienced it for a few weeks and we said, let's just live there. So it's always been this kind of, you get a feeling and say, okay, just roll with it. And that has been liberating in many ways. And now that's kind of, it feels like that's the way we want to live our lives, is because be open to lots of opportunities to help you gain much wider perspective, to then help you see new things that you can become really curious about. And that happened to me in Bali, like curious on so many levels, on so many things. And now I've got my passions and on some really new projects that have just taken me, that I would have never thought I would have wanted to do.
Yeah, which I want to get into in a minute.
Okay.
But first I want to slide back to Detroit. You know, you were born in 69.
69.
And you were basically a child of the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And you moved around a lot. What kind of family did you grow up in? I mean, you and your brother are highly creative people. Where did that come from?
Well, that's a great question. Our family was middle class, upper middle class, but we were always living in areas that were higher class, I guess you'd say. Wherever we lived a little bit beyond our means, okay? So we were always kind of the lesser kids out of all of it, and which was great because you got to see kind of two different ways of being. And I think creatively, my grandfather took me under his wing, and my brother as well, took me under his wing and said, we're going to go and fix all these things. We're going to, he was an educator. He was a tinkerer, handyman. And so his father taught him how to work with his hands. So we would fix everything, fix lawnmowers. We would build soapbox derby racers. Just every weekend, even after school, we were always in the shop doing something, which was great. Wonderful. And we were doing from the age of 3, 4, right? Doing dangerous things that I'm so glad we did. And at the same time, then I had my mom who cared about the aesthetics of everything. She's very house proud, right? She loves the way everything looks and it's got to be just right and what have you. And so when the worlds of my grandfather collided with my mom, right? Obviously there's some tension there.
Yeah.
Because it's
inherently.
Yeah, right. But she had this aesthetic like color and it's got to look right. And my grandfather was make it practical, make it work, just fix it and let's move on. What do you mean? It looks fine. So they would always have these arguments, you know, Dad, you can't do that. It looks like hell. And he's like, what do you mean it works? It works just fine. There's nothing wrong. The door's fine now. But the colors don't match and this. And so through that, I started to see those two different worlds of
function and
function
aesthetics.
And form and aesthetics. And you're like, oh, wait a second. We got to balance these things. And so that was really great. And then on the other side, my dad, he was a head salesman at Levi Strauss, the jeans, right? And so he made sure that wherever, as we were growing up, he was in that division of Levi's, boys wear, kids wear, you know, adult wear, depending on where we were in age. So he would always take out the whole line of clothes and then he'd go, hey, you know, you teach me what gabardine is and seersucker and all the different fabrics and colors and say, put this on and try this. So we had this fashion element because my dad had that. My mom with this kind of house aesthetics and my grandfather with the functionality. And those things would always be coming together in some crazy way. And then there was my love of music, which then informed a whole nother area. And so just blending all that.
And technology. I mean, you were also coming into the world as computers were coming into the world.
Yeah. About 79, 80, I was, you know, 10, 11, the Apple II became my world, right?
How'd you
get one? I traded a hammer for a computer. And so that was an, a major shift that my grandfather never did. He never touched a computer. But it was very interesting because my dad, for Levi's, because it was West Coast, it's, you know, headquartered in San Francisco, they were the first companies to adopt technology.
Mm.
So he had one of those grid laptops, right? And he would have a TI Silent 700, which was a paper terminal with a modem that you put a regular phone in. So I had this, also had this technology thing that also blended in here, and it made me passionate about being able to create things with my hands and with my fingers and my mind on the thing, and you could put them together. So it was this kind of hardware, software world.
Did you like school?
I liked a few subjects, but in general, I did not like school. I didn't like college for the most part. No, I was always, you know, I was thrown out of school a lot.
And how'd you make it to the Valley?
How did I make it to the Valley?
Skipping over the sort of adolescent
moment. It was literally, I had a startup company in college, and I was going to the Valley every few weeks to work with a software distributor and publisher who was taking what we were doing in Michigan and publishing. It was educational software. And so I would go back and forth all the time. And through that, I would read things like Mac Week and Mac World, and I would read about my heroes who created the Apple II or created the Mac. And I was always wondering, what are they doing now? So in one of the articles, the Mac team had gone off to do this company called General Magic. And I didn't know what it was, but it sounded really cool because it was really secretive. So I literally went over to the offices and banged on the door at 8 a.m. And I was 21 at the time, banged on the door and just said, let me in. And are you guys hiring? And it took about 4 to 5 months of, you know, hard persistence to finally ultimately, you know, get a position there. And I was just blown away.
And people should know there's this brilliant documentary that came out about a year ago about General Magic, which is really fantastic because it's one of the most influential moments in Silicon Valley history that very few people know about. What is General Magic?
So General Magic was the Mac team minus Steve, and the goal was to create a personal intelligent communicator. Literally the iPhone 15 years earlier than the iPhone ship. And so it wasn't a pocketable device because the technology wasn't there yet, but it was about the size of a paperback book. And it had a touchscreen interface. It had all graphics. You could do email. You could do email wirelessly. You could download games. You could shop on it. It had a full phone communications as well. So it was this platform that was created, what would be beyond the Mac. And it many of the concepts that we developed there were then ultimately moved on to the iPhone. We were just too early.
Too early, and timing is everything in technology.
And the technology wasn't really ready yet, right? That we were very, very ambitious. But we saw it working, and we had learned so much from that, but yet we were still too ahead of our time.
How heartbreaking was the sort of end of it?
Well, for me, I was devastated. I was, for about 2-3 weeks, literally catatonic because I had put my heart and soul for 4 years. You know, this was my first real thing working for a team that I incredibly respected. 80, 100, 120 hour weeks for 4 years.
Yeah, you famously had a bed in your office.
Yeah, not just me, a few of us had beds in our offices because we just loved what we were doing with the team that we were working with. And we thought we were going to change the world, and everybody convinced us. All the press was telling us we were going to change the world. And so at 21, 22, you know, it became my whole world. I shunned everything. I got rid of everything. I didn't talk to anyone. All I did was work. And then to have it not work. You know, maybe we sold 4,000 to 5,000 devices in the whole world after, you know, a half a billion to $750 million spent on designing and building it. It was a wake up call.
And you were sort of taken down by your parent in a way. I mean, what was it like when the Newton was announced?
Well, it felt like betrayal, right? Because Apple spun us out. Well, I wasn't there, but it spun the project out of Apple and funded this company called General Magic. And so we believed we were going to be the next Apple, so to speak. And then when Apple decided to compete with us, they can say what they wanted, you know, at the time. No, they weren't competing with two totally different things. They were really competing with us. It was hard to see, hard to watch. But at the same time, you know, the Newton failed too. So we were all trying to do the same thing, but there were so many lessons learned, so many bad mistakes. You couldn't ask for a better education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, be at 20, you know, I was 24, 25 by the end of it.
Yeah, some of the guys experienced this in their late 40s.
Right, exactly. They just kind of go along their path. So it was really wonderful to actually have that, because you got to do something that really mattered. But at the same time, then you learned all the things about business and consumers and how to try to communicate with them and try to convince them. And when you learn those in such a dramatic fashion,
publicly,
personally, those stick with you, stick with me ever today. And so when working with entrepreneurs and stuff, it's like, let me tell you these stories. Let me tell you why timing matters. Let me tell you why you have to scope a project a certain way and ship it, and you don't have infinite time to get something out there. It was really great. And remember, this was all pre-internet, right? General Magic was also a victim of the internet. The internet came and we were doing everything kind of like more in late 80s fashion of doing computing, and missed the whole internet wave at General Magic.
Yeah, you had your heads down.
Yeah, we were totally down. Because the project when I started was supposed to only be a year to a year and a half when we were going to ship. You know, it took 4 years.
Yeah, because the aspirations were extraordinary.
Exactly. And the team, the Mac team, always wished that they would have just done one more thing on the Mac and one more thing. So they always kept going, well, we have the money. Let's add one more thing and one more thing. And that was one of the big lessons learned, is less is more. You need to ship in some period of time to make sure that we get feedback from the world, and it, you're never going to make anything perfect, right? The way you learn is by shipping and then iterating.
Exactly. And which you did 18 times with the iPod?
Yeah, 18 different generations on iPod.
So you leave General Magic. You're like, what am I going to do? Do I go back to Michigan? Do I stay here? What do I do? And where do you land?
Well, General Magic, actually, I wanted to save General Magic because I believed in it so much, but I believed that the device we were making was for consumers, but consumers didn't have the mindset. They weren't ready for that kind of product. Wireless communications, they weren't even doing email yet for the most part. And we were going to do it wirelessly. So I said, let's make a business device. And so I designed what would be a business version of General Magic to do certain kinds of things. And they were like, that's really great, Tony, but we're busy. We can't do that. And so I was mad. I was like, what? We got to save this company. We got to save all this work we did. So I went to the various partners of General Magic, Philips being one of them, and pitched them the idea, right? And I had a person from the inside of Philips who got to know me. So she and I went and pitched Philips. And, you know, be careful what you wish for, because you just might get it. So I was 25 and the CEO of Philips goes, yeah, we'll do that device. I was like, what? I was a, you know, lowest man on the totem pole kind of engineer there. And they're like, nope. And you're going to run it and you're going to create this division. So literally went to go to Philips to create a division for them to make mobile computing happen.
With very little leadership skills. And
yeah. And I was like, oh. And I remember the day I got the job, because I was like, oh, this is fun. And I'm meeting the CEO. And I'm like, yeah, it won't happen. But it happened. And I got home. And I was in this little apartment, and I woke up in a cold sweat and said, what did I do? What did I just sign up for?
Now I got to do it.
And wow, that was a whole nother learning experience. But I was panicked for a while. And then the first 6-9 months, because you're just an individual contributor and you have to be a leader building a team in a big company. I'd never been in a big company like that. At that point, they had 375,000 people in this company. I didn't even know what that is. But I just threw myself in it and had to do a lot of personal learning, a lot of learning about myself, learning about how to be a leader in a company, building a device and a team from scratch. And we did it.
And also trying to be a 25-year-old.
And trying to be a 25-year-old, yeah.
Yeah. And then you finally somehow get to Apple.
Yeah.
What's that story?
The Apple story. So after Philips, I went to go start my own company, trying to reinvent consumer electronics. So everything at that point in the mid-90s, late 90s, was all analog you know, there was CDs still, but everything else was analog. It was components. It was no flat screens yet. And I was like, what, how could we revolutionize consumer electronics? Because it was really mail. It was really, you know, you go to some pro shop and you put each piece together and it's, you know, I was like, this is just too hard. And at Philips, I also learned about, at that time, MP3s. And watched that whole MP3.
Compression was just starting.
Yeah, digital compressions, because people were taking the digital audio off the CDs because they weren't encrypted, protected. And you could then, you know, just kind of play them a little bit, you know, and there's no memory really, but you could play them back on computers. It was sort of interesting. And so this company was all about making digital consumer electronics with a whole new retail and purchase experience on the internet. You could configure it or it would be configured for you. And then it would just be delivered and you could set it up. And so one of the key components that we were building was a little rack mounted or a desktop mounted CD player with a hard drive in it. So the CD player, as you put it in, it would rip the tunes and put it onto a hard drive. And then you could have a jukebox of thousands of songs, but it was on a big hard drive, a, you know, 5 1/4 inch hard drive. And so we're building that, and the internet crisis happened of 2000, right? Nobody wanted to fund anything. Startups, the startup environment froze, nuclear winter set in. And especially any startup that was doing hardware, they didn't want to talk to anybody doing hardware. So I was sitting there panicked, and we were changing the company, trying to get other funding, and I did like over 80 pitches to venture capitals, and no, it was just rejection after rejection. It was like brutal. So I decided to take a little time off, and my friend said, oh, come out skiing. So I was just trying to clear my brain of what was going to be next, because this, it was clear that this company was on its last legs, because it was about 8 months after that internet crunch. And lo and behold, I get a phone call. And I'm on the ski slope in Vail. I'm getting on a chairlift. And it was a person from Apple. And he's like, a friend of mine told me you could consult for us. I said, what? And it turned out that I had lunch just before I went on this trip with a friend of mine who I knew from General Magic, who worked there. And he knew this person at Apple, and so on and so forth. And literally because of that lunch, and I told him what was going on in my company, then he told his friend from Apple, and then I got the call. And literally, I had been working on a lot of the same things. It wasn't the iPod in a mini form, but it was in this larger form. And then I was brought in and as a consultant for the first 6-8 weeks to say, we see MP3 players out there. We think they're all crap. What would be an Apple version of that? Could you come in and consult with us and look at that? And that's what I did.
And what was the culture of the company at the time?
Oh, Apple? Well, Apple was, you know, it had the iMac, but the iMac kind of went to the Mac loyalists and then it died. So the stock was running up in 2000 when all the internet stocks were down. Apple was way up. And then all of a sudden, it hit a wall. There were nobody else was buying Macs after the Mac loyalists. So the company was in the doldrums. Like, I think it was barely break even from a company perspective. They weren't winning against Windows and Microsoft. Michael Dell was like, oh, from Dell Computer, said, oh, people, they should just close down Apple and give the money back to all the shareholders. So it was a pretty dour timer on Apple. And to, you know, come in and do iPod in this kind of not so nice environment with constrained resources and everybody was fighting for their lives, we had to really prove ourselves to try to make that product happen.
How quickly did you meet Steve Jobs?
So after the I had started in the end of January, first week of February, and then the middle of March, was the first time I met Steve in a Apple meeting. I'd met Steve once, twice before at some other parties. But yeah, an Apple meeting was March 2001.
And at the time, you had a huge amount of respect for him. I mean, this was one of your...
Oh, absolutely. I had a healthy dose of incredible respect for him. But I also heard all the stories from being at General Magic and the Mac team. So I also had this tons of fear as well. Because I heard about the days of the Mac, you know, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And so I was like nervous as all hell, right? Going into that first meeting with Steve. But it turned out, you know, time, you know, mellows everyone. And he was a very, very different from what I had imagined him to be from the stories that I was told at the General Magic time.
Yeah, because all of a sudden you're working with him.
Yeah. We're literally working. We're working together with him because he was like, well, I see this in the design. More of this, less of that. Can you do this? What do you think about that? And it was really, that first meeting was really amazing because he greenlit the project right then and there after about almost 2 hour meeting.
Mm. And then you guys worked together for a number of years.
Yeah, 10 years after that.
And you saw a lot during that period of time. Do you think that his management style was effective? Do you think that, you know, sort of you have to govern with an iron fist to produce results?
His management style was absolutely effective. He was definitely respected, okay? You have to, when it comes to opinion-based decisions, especially when Apple was in its, you know, it was all about computers. We're going to go do consumer electronics. And it was his opinion that was the right way forward for Apple. And it was, there was no facts or a fact-based decision. It was like, this is what we're going to do. And you had to have that will to do it and that energy behind it that, you know, we willed that thing into existence through the entire organization because it needed to happen. And so I think it was absolutely effective. And I learned so much from him as to how to transform a business, a culture, to make things happen when the environment around you didn't want it to happen, right? And at the same time, you know, you learn some things that you don't want to necessarily do too, right? Because you have to have a team and the team has to be cohesive. And individuals also have to be rewarded for their individual contributions.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you learned a lot of things by watching him do it the right way. And you learned a few things by watching him do it the wrong way. But would I ever trade that? No. I have those same, you know, in a different way. I have those same challenging spots, just like he had some challenging spots. We all have those. But I'd much rather have that blend than to have someone who can't will things into existence. If you want to change the world, it is by your spirit. It's by your intelligence. It's by your passion that you get people to follow you and make that reality. And I don't know any other way to do it.
Yeah. And I mean, your period there was the golden age of Apple. This is when the iPod was invented, the iPhone was introduced to the world. That was sort of the most fundamental shifts that happened from a technology company and culture.
Yeah, and changed society, you know. We look back at 2007 and before 2007 and before the iPod, Apple was a different company. Our society was very different.
Mm.
And to make those two huge shifts when the world said we could never do it is just, you know, it's very rewarding.
And while you were there, you met your wife.
I absolutely did. A year after I was there.
And you guys were together during the period you were both at Apple.
Yeah, we were there. We were together almost from the day we met each other, which was on a blind date in the Apple buildings. We had a blind date in the Apple.
Because no one ever left.
We were always working. We were always working. But yeah, and then we were together and we both left at the same time as well.
And how did you feel when you left Apple?
How did I feel? Apple, at that time, I can't speak for now, but was an absolutely amazing ride. But kind of like General Magic, you know, you kind of say, oh, I've kind of outgrown this in a way. I've learned a lot of things, and I think it's time for me to get to new ground, new ways of thinking, new ways of working on different things. You know, we talked about 18 generations of the iPod. You know, how many times are you going to turn that crank, right? And you have a formula and it works great. And then the iPhone, we were already on our third generation at that point by the time I left. And I was like, oh, I'm going to go through 18 generations now. And you saw, you know, the release last week of the 11th iPhone 11 or whatever it was. You know, you're just like, wait a second, do I want to get on this treadmill again? And we had a 1- and a 2-year-old, my wife and I, that we didn't see, right? Because we were working so hard. So there was one, which is my personal thing of how am I challenging myself? And then we had our family, right? And these kids needed parents around and couldn't, you know, that were stressed out all the time and that were, you know, always.
And you're also seeing so many people around you who aren't making that choice.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And, you know, Steve was really, really interesting when it came down to the us leaving, which is he said, he's like, because I remember when we told him we were pregnant and he was like, oh, you know, it was like a big deal. We told him he was married. That was a whole nother story. But when we told him we were pregnant, he was like very supportive. You know, people will say what you want about Steve and in other things, but he was incredibly supportive. And he would take me and my wife on our long walks and sit with each of us and talk about kids and how he, what he learned from kids. It was really, really a wonderful experience to share with him. But when we actually said, oh, we have kids, and he was like, I was wondering when you guys were going to do that. I thought you were going to do it sooner. So that was a, you know, he had already been through that in his mind of like, they will leave. At least my wife will leave because she'll want to be with the kids more. And then when we both did it, it was like, okay, I get it. So we had clocked forward. Everything had clocked forward, personally, our family, and it was just the right time.
And you exited the bubble and you were out.
Exited the bubble and definitely we were out.
And then what?
And then we went touring the world. So we went on a 1.5-year tour around the world, going to different cities with our kids, spending 2 to 4 weeks, sometimes longer, in different places to just get outside of Silicon Valley and learn about different ways of living and getting inspiration and figuring out what could possibly be next and spending time with the kids.
And then your next big innovation happened. And it's interesting how innovation seemed to come from disappointment. You were building a house, and out of that came Nest.
Yeah, Nest came. And Nest was really an idea that I had because, you know, I had always been, I was building and doing stuff with my grandfather back in the day, you know, making different things, fixing different things. And so when it came to building this house and designing it, I wanted to be the most green connected house. And so I started looking for different products. And one thing was a thermostat because you're going to, you know, and I couldn't find anything. And so while I'm looking for those products to go in the house, we're also traveling around the world. And I'm going to all these different houses and living in different houses. And they all have the same problems. There's no good thermostats. None of these different household kind of infrastructure technology products worked or were beautiful. And I was like, oh my God, this is a worldwide problem. You think like sometimes you go to Europe and you're like, oh, you know, they have better furniture. Cause back in the 90s or the 80s, it's like we didn't have any contemporary furniture. It was all in Europe and then it came. So you're like, oh, I'm going to go over there. I'm going to find stuff. It wasn't there. I was like, wait a second. And then I was like, how do you build and how do you design these things? And I was like, oh, I know how to do that. So while I'm on the road and, you know, designing virtually the house, and living in these houses with the same problems I'm trying to design out, I was like, okay, well, let's start designing and researching the products and thinking about it.
Right. And then it was acquired by Google for an enormous amount of money. Yeah. Yeah. And then you re-enter a huge organization.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know how much you want to talk about that, but I'm sure leaving that felt good.
Oh, leaving another large organization? Absolutely. It was freedom. It was freedom again to design. You know, I love the team that we had built at Nest. I love the culture we had built at Nest. It was hard charging. It was make it happen. Team spirit, go for it. And, you know, in any organization, whether it's Apple or Philips or Google or anything that any of the other ones I see, you know, there's one which is the work. And then there's all the other ancillary stuff that goes with the work, which is organizational dysfunction. And to have to step into it again is, it's like, I've been there, I've done that, why am I doing that again, right? Yeah.
You didn't need the money. You had young kids. There was anything you could do. So why were you there?
I had gone because I wanted to take the vision bigger. We weren't done. We were by no means, we were just getting started. But I had been in the Valley 25 years at that point, 24 years. And I saw how people's egos, and they said, we're going to topple this large company. We're going to take over. And I know how hard it was to fulfill the vision that we wanted to build at Nest. It was a big, big vision. And to go the distance was going to be very, very hard. And I did not want to lose that because we had 200 people at that point and families that I and my co-founder were responsible for. And they had joined us along the trip. And we were that fast rising star. We were doing all that. And sometimes you have to put your own issues aside and you have to say, I got to do what's best for the vision. I have to do what's best for the teams and to make sure that this lives on. Right.
Yeah.
And so, and I also know that when big companies decide to get on your turf, they can really spoil things for you. When you're the biggest company on a small hill and then the big guys show up, you don't want that. You want to change the landscape before they change it on you. Mm. And so I wanted to be the first mover on changing the landscape.
Yeah.
And that was the other thing.
Right.
So all of those things came together to say, now is the right time. Because we could have been at it, these other guys came in, and then it could have been gone. And I saw it too many times.
Right, and that was kind of the end of the Valley for you.
That was the end, yeah.
And before we move on, I just did want to ask, you know, in this industry obsessed with speed, you seem to have done things at your own pace, and you seem to really respond well to this idea of slowing down and sort of observing the underlying assumptions that are happening surrounding something. At that time, were you feeling like you didn't have the time to really make the moves? Were you feeling like there were pressures on your time that were making you make decisions that you didn't necessarily want to be making? Or did you just feel like you wanted to slow it all down altogether?
After the Google experience and the Nest experience, yeah. So when I was at General Magic, when the disaster happened, I went away for 3 weeks to the desert to go ponder, to think, to get clear again. When I was at Philips, I took two sabbaticals, basically 6 to 8 weeks each, one to Latin America or 12 weeks, Latin America and then the Middle East with just me in a backpack. And I found those to be incredible experiences to write your brain, right? To get outside of it. To gain perspective and go, okay, how do I really want to take the next steps? Because as you say, things move really fast and you are running from fire to fire and you're trying to beat the competition, whatever, and you lose all grounding at some points. And so then we did it at Apple, right? We took the time off at Apple. Yeah. So to me, I was like, I learned from those experiences, like, okay, it's time to just
done.
Everybody worries about jumping to the next lily pad. Everybody worries about like, oh, if I don't have a job now, I'm not going to get in one. People are going to say, well, what did you do for those 6 months? Why didn't you go right to work? Or your family goes, well, what are you going to do for money for the next 6 months? And so all of these external fears come in and you're like, it feels like society is pushing that you have to leap to the next thing, right? And some of it's in your mind and some of it is external. And if you take that time and you give yourself that buffer, you'll find that usually those are fabricated and you can very easily push away all the other stuff that people are coming at you with and you can make much better decisions. So I've had lots of people who call me, who worked for me, and they are in the place that I was, like, oh, I'm quitting, I can't take it anymore, or it's time's up here. And I'm like, go get bored. Take 6 months, get bored. Literally go do all the things you wished you would have done for the last 5 years when you were at that company working like crazy. Go do those things.
Or do nothing.
That means, when I mean like, go take that trip,
yeah.
Go whatever. Go get incredibly bored, do nothing. Don't do what you have to do for work. Go do other things. Gain perspective. And then you come back with fresh ideas, and you can almost like reboot yourself. Version 2.0, version 3.0.
Which you've done multiple times in your life.
Trying, keep trying.
And you decide to move to Paris, and then you decide to open Future Shape. Tell me a little bit about Future Shape and what you're most excited about right now that you're working on there.
Future Shape is a, what we call an advisory and investment firm, but really for us, I call ourselves mentors with money. So we are investors in startup companies around the world doing deep technology startups. Things that are really, really hard. Most VCs would never fund. They're not software-based. They're not consumer-based. They're things that can disrupt the world in the right way to make societies better, communities better, our environment better. And so we want to support those entrepreneurs who are trying to do hard things and try to bring our network, not just money, but bring our network, our experience to help them the way I was helped to get to where I am today, right? Mm. Through mentors. So I think it's time to give back and put your money where your mouth is, help these people and try to change the world. So I got to do it a few times, luckily and successfully. So let's try to do that, but at a scale of hundreds of companies, not just one company that I would do myself, so that we can take this, what I think is an art, right? A true art form and instill that and help to train people and learn by doing so that we can have more artists out there. Just think about this. How many people really worked closely with Steve at Apple or the Macintosh team or some of these world-changing things? If you have that experience, I think it's almost a requirement that you go and help to spread that knowledge around. Because that's what we have to do as artists, because the art will die.
Absolutely. Right?
And so I want to, and our team wants to do that for so many things, and not just consumer electronics. We're doing it in biotech, med tech, agriculture technology, food technology, finance technology, all the places where the tools and things that we've created are now colliding with industries that are totally transforming and will transform because of technology.
And you're continuing to be able to fuse your own personal curiosities and interests into your investments.
Oh, yeah.
Like Impossible Foods, you're working on scooters that are electric powered in Asia. You're doing all of these things that are actually just ways that you, in real terms, want to change the world. A lot of people are talking about changing the world. Very few people have the ability and know-how to actually affect these industries. I mean, look at what's happening with Impossible Foods. Burger King.
Yeah, Burger King, White Castle.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. The team's amazing. You know, I have to give them credit. I was there in the early days, but that's really them doing it. You know, they're really,
yeah, well, at
really
this
good.
Point, that's your role with these companies. I mean, how many of these companies are you actually hands-on doing design and engineering? And
oh, very, you know, it's working with the CEO to help them see what they need to do and letting them know. It's not about actually doing it. In a few cases, we do, but most of the time, it's about helping to give them the confidence so that they can make the decisions, right? Sometimes they get an analysis paralysis. Sometimes they don't see they have a blind spot in the product or in the business or in something. And so what we're trying to do is just help them and augment them so that they can be successful. So that's really rewarding because, you know, you have kids and you know, when they take that next step and you're there watching them and you see it and you're like, you feel so proud and you just help them and nudge them and say, no, do more of that. Give them a little bit more risk, you know, so they learn. That's what we do. That's what we do with all these entrepreneurs and businesses. We don't want to take credit for what they do. We just want to help push them and make sure that the vision that they have can be fulfilled and do it with as minimum disruption as possible.
And what's amazing is you now have this outside perspective looking from Paris, Bali, wherever you're living now, back at the Valley. You have great friends there. You have a strong history there. But you were also one of the first people to come out to speak up against what was happening, especially with screen addiction and some of the sort of social issues that you've taken on and held these people to task. Has it been sad for you to see how much the Valley has changed? And do you feel a certain responsibility to keep them in check in a way?
Well, I don't think of myself as a policeman or anything like that. But I think that, look, when you create something or help to create it and things are going awry, you need to step in and state what it is. Because a lot of people are still in the system and they have to make ends meet and they can't necessarily speak up for what's going on. They might feel it. They might talk about it at the dinner table or their friends in confidence, but they're not going to go out and say it.
No.
And so,
I mean, especially when NDAs run the Valley.
Oh, NDAs and relationships and everything else. But, you know, I just remember, and this was a thing that I've met from my mentors, which was when there's something going on and it's not right, stand up and say it and say, you know, but make sure you do it in a constructive way. Make sure that you've talked to the people before you say it to see if you can get it resolved.
Mm.
Try to come to terms. And if you can't, then just go all out and just say what you mean. Offer good solutions, not just complaining, and try to reframe it so that people can see it and hopefully fix it, right? And you get to that point in your career where you got to do those things, especially when it's something that's important about society, family, community, and it's something that you were involved in building initially, right? Sure, I could be a critic on everybody's products and you could go off and be a pundit. Yeah, whatever. When it's really a social impact thing, you need to speak up, or an environmental, you need to speak up and you need to try to make change. If you're not on the inside doing it, and you should be on the inside, if you are on the inside, speaking up about it as much as you can. But when you're on the outside and you have credibility and some kind of relationship to the thing, you need to really to say, come on, guys, let's do what's right. Mm. Let's do it. Let's really understand what's going on. It's not about the dollar. It's not about this stuff. You know, and some of my personal relationships were affected by doing that. But I'm like, guys, this isn't personal.
Yeah.
This isn't personal. This is all about doing the right thing. And when you're on the side of that and you think you're right and you talk to other people and they go, yeah, thank you for saying it. You go, okay, I'm going to keep doing it. And yeah, I might, you know, get scars on my back and people might not like it, but you got to speak up.
But Silicon Valley has gone unchecked for a long time. And there is a hubristic approach to business and to the rest of society that has developed out there. And we need a conversation about it. And people aren't really having it because it's not sort of institutionally focused. It's not you're bad. It's a sort of cultural problem out there.
Yeah, the Valley has changed a lot since I got there in 91.
Yeah.
Okay. I watched the craziness of the internet of 2000, right? And we're like, oh my God, where did all these people come from? They're all talking about this and the money, it went money crazy and then it fell apart. And the Valley went back to being the Valley. But then through multiple things, through the early 2000s and then the social mobile with the iPhone and all the other stuff, it got really crazy and money flowing and people not, you know, thinking straight. They're like, oh, we're just a tech platform. We don't really affect society. Society just lives on our platform. You have to understand that you are affecting societies. People are learning from this. This might be one of their only ways of getting information. And I think there were two really big things. One was the technology got adopted so rapidly. And the other one is many of these leaders, they were like, I was when I was 24, 25, and they literally had these technologies that could be used for mass good or mass bad. And they're like, they're just technologies and I'm just trying to do the right thing. And they're like naive and innocent and we're just changing the world and it's going to be all good. it's until they actually had kids and families and they understood, like, oh my God, my kids are seeing this stuff. And then they start getting some conscience. But the problem is the cat's already out of the bag. And now it's like, we got to roll it back. I think if the leaders of those companies actually had their own kids and they actually saw the realities and the technology grew a little bit more slowly so we could watch some of this stuff, it literally exploded in a year and a half, 2 years. And it was just like, it was everywhere.
The tyranny of speed.
And you're just like, oh my God, what did we unleash? And now to put it back in, you know, I bet you we would make a lot of different decisions than we did. Some of these leaders would.
Do you think it's savable?
You got to have hope. Form? If you don't have hope, you know, a lot of times cultures that are built and platforms that are built, it's easier to build new ones than it is to try to change the ones that are there. And you're going to have to let those die out. And people are going to learn that, no, I don't want this. I want this instead. And they'll have a choice as opposed to trying to make something that's morph something from where it is today into this other thing. I think it is going to be a generational thing and we'll pass by it and there'll be a new set with new brands and people like, I like that more. I saw a very interesting research article about a month ago and it was all about companies trying to do right by the environment. And they said, consumers trusted new brands who wanted to take the environment and do the right thing for the environment than older brands who had been doing the same thing for years and then all of a sudden said they had this one product line that's environmentally friendly or whatever. Customers would much rather go to a new brand doing it the right way than try to trust an old brand who was doing it the wrong way and they're now saying they're doing it the right way.
Yeah.
So I think that's what's going to be with not just environmental issues, but all of these social and technology platform media things. I think we're all going to see a trend away to something else.
Yeah.
As opposed to trying to fix what's there.
Something much more humanistic, something that honors who we are biologically.
And that states its principles up front of what it is.
Yeah.
And says, you know, I just remember when Steve, when we had the iTunes media store and, you know, people were like, well, we should have any kind of content we want on it. And he's like, absolutely not. Of course we could have porn and we could make money with that. But is that what you want for your kids? Do you want to say when your kids ask, you say, don't watch porn, but yet you're selling it. Is that going to be the right thing? You're going to be a hypocrite. He's like, you have to put your ethics, morals, social responsibility into the things that you build because of the world that you want to leave for your kids and their generation. So you need to make a this is good and a bad statement, just like how you have to train your kids. This is right. This is wrong. We need to have that in our platforms, in our media, and we need to state that up front when people sign up, as opposed to this just a generic thing and you can do whatever you want. You know, you can't go into a restaurant and say whatever you want and, you know, troll people and stuff like that. People will kick you out. Those are private spaces. Well, technology, our social platforms can be private spaces too.
Yeah.
And they can be policed and controlled and done right if the creators so choose to do so and want to put their stamp of this is what we believe this society, this online society should be like and kick people off.
Well, hopefully the work you're doing at Future Shape and everywhere else is going to create opportunities for leaders that are like that.
We hope. We hope.
Thank you for coming on today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. You can find more episodes of the Time Sensitive Podcast on our website, timesensitive.fm, or on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv.